question for the evening that was drawn out last time. We know very little about the original followers of Jesus. Historically, what can we learn about those followers, and I would also say from those followers? Okay. Who were those 12? Which one? Judas named Thaddeus. Yes, actually, he is surnamed Thaddeus, and you generally hear of him as Thaddeus, not Judas, because of what happened later. While we're at it, we will put that other Judas up there as well. Paul's a later follower, David. The early followers. I know. Well, the disciples. Give me an opportunity to go before somebody said. Well, but I avoided that one. Okay. Andrew's up here. He also started a group later after they finished making jeans. His name was Levi. James? Which one? And then we've got James, son of Alphaeus. Alphaeus. That's nine of them. Even though they misspelled it, they only use one L in the Greek. Philip. That's 10. Only have two more to go. No. Yeah, that one that as a kid thought perhaps that was the name of the animal on which one of the others rode, because we thought it was Bartholomew. Many scholars think that he was also Nathaniel. There's one more. He was a rather zealous character. Simon Zealotes, or Simon the Zealot. He was rather zealous about his... Those are the 12 that are initially chosen. Of course, later, after the death of Judas Iscariot in the book of Acts, they choose another to replace Judas, and Matthias is chosen. But that is a later development. Actually, there are four places that we have lists of these disciples. One is in Matthew chapter 10, verses 2 through 4. Mark chapter 3, verses 16 through 19. Luke chapter 6, verses 13 through 16. And Acts chapter 1, verse 13. Those are the four places that the disciples are listed. And in some places you will find different names given for some of those disciples. But in Mark, which is the oldest gospel, we read, he went up the mountain and called to him those whom he wanted, and they came to him, and he appointed 12, whom he had also named apostles, to be with him, and to be sent out to proclaim the message, and to have the authority to cast out demons. Then in verses 16 to 19, so he appointed the 12, Simon, to whom the name he gave Peter, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, the brother of James, to whom he gave the name Boanerges, that is, sons of thunder, and Andrew, and Philip, and Bartholomew, and Matthew, and Thomas, and James, son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus, who is the other Judas, and Simon the Cananean, who is Simon Zealotes, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. So those are the 12 of Jesus' closest followers. We know a lot about some of them. And so we will talk in no particular order about some of the things that we know of these earliest followers of Jesus. Most of what we know about many of them is contained in the biblical text itself and not in other witnesses, although some of the early church fathers do speak of some of them. But first, Simon Peter. The name Peter appears 155 times in the New Testament referring to the disciple. By far, the most number of times. Actually, the word is Petros, which means stone or rock. So he was the original Rocky. The Aramaic form is Cephas or Kephas, and is used only one time at all in the Gospels, and that's in John chapter 1, verse 42. That's the only place that Cephas, the Aramaic term Cephas or Kephas, is used to speak of Simon Peter in the Gospels. It is used to speak of him 8 times in Galatians and 1 Corinthians. So he is known primarily as Simon or Simon Peter or Petros in the Gospels. If you go to look up Simon or Simon Zealotes, in a lot of Bible dictionaries, you will have to look, they will send you from S-I-M-O-N to S-Y-M-E-O-N. Because Simeon is the Aramaic form, and that was what he would have been known as, was Simeon in Aramaic. His father was John, or Jonah. But what's really interesting is John chapter 1, verse 44 says that his home was in Bethsaida, just a few miles from Capernaum. And yet, in most other places, he is Simon Peter of the fishing village of Capernaum around the Sea of Galilee. Some people think that Bethsaida was really kind of a suburb of Capernaum. In fact, in Matthew chapter 8, Mark chapter 1, and Luke chapter 4, he is mentioned as being from Capernaum. He and his brother Andrew were fishermen. Simon Peter was married. And what's really interesting, we oftentimes overlook a lot of things when we read the text, especially when in the New Testament, because we think we're so familiar with it that we just kind of skim through the passages. But in Matthew chapter 8, Jesus has gone on the mountain. And this is another telling of the story in Mark chapter 1. We find when Jesus entered Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law lying in bed with a fever. So he was married. His wife was around sometimes and they would stop in his house. And his mother-in-law stayed with them. And so we do know that while later on tradition says Simon Peter gave up his home, that sometimes they would come back through Capernaum and spend the night or spend a few days at his house. He may have been a follower of John the Baptist before he followed Jesus, like his brother. We do know that Andrew was a follower of John the Baptist prior to his following Jesus. We find that in the Gospel according to John. And there is an unnamed follower of Andrew, or of John the Baptist, with Andrew, who many scholars seem to think was indeed his brother Simon. When they were told by John that Jesus is the Messiah and they must go and follow him. And then they go up to Jesus. He was not illiterate. You know, oftentimes we have images of the disciples as being totally illiterate. Simon Peter was not illiterate. But he didn't have the traditional training by a rabbi that one would anticipate in a synagogue. In fact, there's some questions as to how faithful he might have been to the synagogue simply because of his fishing duties. And a lot of times the fishing took place. You know, we think when we go fishing, when do we do most of our fishing? Okay, for leisure. And when, as far as, do we do it in the daytime or at night? Most people do it during the daytime. Early in the morning, during the day, or late in the evening. Although some people do fish at night. But most people, and you know, they're riding around in the boats with big spotlights to attract the fish. But most people, at least in my experience, grew up fishing during the daytime. Whether it was early morning or late in the afternoon. But oftentimes, Simon and Andrew and others would fish all night long. And so if they would fish all night long and then the Sabbath comes up and it's a time of rest, what do you think they did? Oftentimes they'd rest and sleep in. So while he may not have been that faithful to the synagogue, but he did not have rabbinical training. His native language was Aramaic, though he knew some Greek. It's interesting to note that Simon Peter's name appears at the top of every, or at the head of every list given anywhere of the disciples. He's always the first one listed. He was part of Jesus' inner circle. That inner circle included Peter, James, and John. Yes. Very often when Jesus would go to the side, or when Jesus raised Jairus' daughter, who did he take into the room with him from the disciples? Peter, James, and John. When the disciples went to the Garden of Gethsemane, who did he take further in where he prayed? Peter, James, and John. Up on the Mount of Transfiguration, Peter, James, and John. So Simon Peter and the brothers, James and John, seem to compose kind of the innermost circle of Jesus' disciples. Woke everybody up. And he was often the spokesman for the disciples. What's really interesting is that Mark, the gospel writer, according to tradition, John Mark, was seen as the scribe of Simon Peter, recording a lot of sermons and remembrances that Peter had of Jesus. And yet, of the gospel writers, Mark is the least flattering to Simon Peter. Of course, that may have also been some of Peter's own sense of guilt for denying Jesus. Matthew actually exalts Peter higher than anybody else, any of the other gospel writers. Luke elevates him as well, but Matthew exalts him the highest of all. He's a leading character early in the book of Acts. Peter is the one that calls the disciples, gets them all together, the disciples and the women and the other followers in the upper room. It is Peter who says, well, Judas isn't here. Jesus chose 12. We need to choose another one to complete the group. It is Peter who initially preaches that sermon at Pentecost while the others repeat what he is saying. It is Peter who is found in chapters 3 and following preaching. It is Simon Peter later on who raises the dead woman and is taken, therefore is in Joppa, the house of Simon the Tanner, and goes to the house of Cornelius, the Roman centurion, and preaches the gospel to the Roman centurion and his whole household. So Peter is very key in the early church's life, especially in the book of Acts. He's the most frequently mentioned disciple in the Gospel of John. And in Galatians, Paul acknowledges him as the leader of the church in Jerusalem, as the source of much of Paul's information about the life of Jesus, and calls him the apostle to the Jews. So Peter, very obviously not only chosen by Jesus, but in other people's minds in the early church, figures very highly and very significantly. Although we do know that Paul in Galatians chapter 2 also rebuked Peter for being somewhat two-faced, where he's eating with Gentiles and then a bunch of Jewish Christians come in, and so he pushes away from the Gentiles and goes and eats with the Jewish Christians and won't associate with the Gentile Christians. And Paul does call him on the carpet for that. Peter led the Jerusalem church for approximately 10 years before becoming a traveling evangelist in Acts chapter 9. And according to church tradition, about A.D. 44, he flees for his life. In 1 Corinthians chapter 1, chapter 3, and chapter 9, we are told that he ministered in Corinth. And then later he went to Asia Minor and Rome. So Peter got around a good bit, but he was the leader. And in a lot of ways, he was much more the leader than we think. In the early church, if you began a Christian church or a church who were early on they were called followers of the way somewhere else, it was only recognized as a legitimate church if Peter and the Jerusalem church recognized it as a legitimate church. So he had a great deal of authority, which eventually leads in church tradition to the idea that he becomes the first pope. Church tradition confirms the implication of 1 Peter 5:13 that he did go to Rome. Of course, church tradition claims that he founded the church in Rome and served as bishop there, and that's where he was martyred under Nero in A.D. 64 to 65. And supposedly, according to church tradition, though the Bible never says this, Peter was crucified. And how was he crucified? Right, upside down. Because the claim was that he did not feel worthy enough to be crucified in the same fashion as Jesus was. And so he was crucified upside down. You could go to other church traditions. You could read in Roman Catholic literature many, many things about Simon Peter in church tradition that we don't find in the biblical text. Some that we find evidence for, some that we don't. But in a nutshell, that's what we know about Simon Peter. That leader who was all too human, and even though he suffered from foot and mouth disease, because a lot of times he'd just stick his foot in his mouth when he'd go to say something, who said, "I'll die before I deny you," and then turned around and denied Jesus three times and invoked a curse on himself. If he knew the man, and he said he didn't. And yet, even someone in that kind of leadership authority, while some put him on a pedestal, should not have been on a pedestal. That's why I tell you all the time, I tell folks all the time, and I've told you all a number of times, you know, I get very nervous when people start putting folks in ministry on pedestals. Far too often, people begin believing the pedestal hype, and that's when they get in trouble. So Peter is that example of one who worked very hard and was very zealous about what he did on behalf of the church, but at the same time proved to be all too human as well. What about his brother Andrew? His Greek name means manly, and he was a fisherman and a disciple of John the Baptist. John chapter 1, verses 35 to 42. He and an unidentified disciple of John were the first ones to follow Jesus. What do we think of, though, when we think of Andrew? Who did he tell first, "We found the Messiah," which makes me question whether it was really Peter or not that was one of the disciples of John the Baptist. We think of Andrew went immediately and told his brother, We have found a Messiah. In both Mark chapter 1 and Matthew chapter 4, we find that he and Peter were fishing when Jesus issued their call. And Jesus later visited in his home in Capernaum. He is always listed among the first four names in the lists of disciples. In John, Andrew appears with Philip in a number of places. He is the one who brings the boy with the loaves and fishes in John chapter 6. He is the one in John chapter 12 who brings Greek pilgrims to Jesus, Gentiles. Well, there's a question as to whether Gentiles can come to Jesus or not. It is Andrew who goes out and brings them in. Each time he is mentioned in the Gospel of John, Andrew is always, he is in the process of bringing somebody to Jesus. He's a very zealous missionary. When he found the Messiah, he wanted to tell people and then take them there to prove this is the Messiah. Outside of these incidents and the four lists of disciples that I mentioned, Andrew is never mentioned again in the New Testament. In early church legends, according to the church historian Eusebius, Andrew eventually works in Scythia, which is north of the Black Sea. What country would that be? Could have been Turkey, go further north. Russia. In fact, guess what? Andrew, as the church developed and the Russian Orthodox Church developed, guess who the patron saint of the Russian Orthodox Church is? Saint Andrew. Now, I don't know if he ever made it to Scotland and designed any golf courses or not. No, St. Andrew is the patron saint of the Russian Orthodox Church. And so the tradition is that he went to Russia, to Scythia, north of the Black Sea. He ministered in Russia, started several churches there, and later was crucified in Achaia, which is Greece. That's all we know about Andrew, except for some of those church legends, especially in the Russian Orthodox Church. But what we do know historically is that every time Andrew is mentioned in the Bible, outside of simply listing his name, Andrew is telling somebody about Jesus as Messiah. Bringing somebody to meet Jesus as Messiah. We've got a couple of Jameses up here. One of those is James, the son of Alphaeus. He is mentioned in the lists of disciples. And the only other mention of his name is at the crucifixion of Jesus. We know he was part of the group. And even church tradition doesn't go beyond that. Other than the mention of his name with his mother, who is present at the crucifixion, the mother of James, the son of Alphaeus. So in addition to these folks, and there will be several of these like this, I would venture that in addition to the folks that are out front, Simon Peter, Andrew, James, son of Zebedee, John, son of Zebedee, and some of the others, there were a lot of them that were simply working in the background, going around doing the everyday tasks, not for any kind of recognition, but simply because Christ had chosen them. And James, the son of Alphaeus, is one of those from whom we can learn that while there are some that are more out front and up front than others, there always must be folks who work strongly and in some cases plottingly for the mission to continue and to fully bear fruit. James, the son of Zebedee, his name is actually a version of Jacob. The Hebrew name is Yaakov, or Jacob. James is simply a version of Jacob. He is among the first disciples that are called by Jesus. He is one of those that Jesus later calls a son of thunder, Boanerges, James and John. Some people have thought that maybe he had, in fact, New Testament theologian Richard Wilson said that's because James had a volatile temper. James and John wanted to call down destruction on a Samaritan city because they shirked the disciples and didn't speak well of Jesus. So, that's where he gets that idea that Jesus called them sons of thunder because they, both James and John, had volatile tempers. He was part of the inner circle of the disciples. And in Acts, he is part of the Jerusalem church. Part of the founding of that early church. And is martyred by Herod Agrippa I, according to Acts chapter 12, about 44 A.D. He refused to recant his belief in Jesus as Messiah, and he died for that belief and for that leadership. He's not the same James that led the Jerusalem church, also known as James the Just. And he's not the James who is the brother of Jesus, who became a follower later, but not early in Jesus' ministry. But he is James, the son of Zebedee, whose brother was John. That name is mentioned regarding him about 30 times in the New Testament. It's interesting, though, that he is not mentioned by name in the Gospel of John, and so that has led many people to presume that he was whom? What disciple is mentioned several times in the Gospel of John without a name? The disciple whom Jesus loved, the beloved disciple. We don't know. Read an interesting article in a book last year where New Testament theologian said that actually, from evidence and from simple culture, he had decided that probably the disciple Jesus loved was his brother James, who later became a follower because he would naturally love him. I don't think the evidence was convincing, but that's kind of a presumption. Like, we presume that John was the disciple whom Jesus loved, but we don't know for sure. Tradition identifies him as the author not only of the Gospel of John, but the book of Revelation and 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John. If so, he lived a whole lot longer than most people did in his day. He probably would have been in his 80s or 90s at the time that he penned those. He and his brother James are, as I said, sons of Zebedee and Salome, who was the sister of Mary, the mother of Jesus, which would have made them first cousins to Jesus. And he and James were partners in the fishing business with Peter and Andrew. Their home was in Capernaum, and he was part of the inner circle again. He is rebuked by Jesus when he and James, as I said a moment ago in Luke chapter 9, 54, want to call destruction on a Samaritan village. He is rebuked when he forbids outsiders to cast out demons. Mark chapter 9, verse 38, he comes to Jesus and said, "Lord, we found this guy out here casting out demons in your name, and he's not one of us, and he needs to be punished." Which once again may be the reason that Jesus called James and John Boanerges, sons of thunder. And they are rebuked, James and John, when they in one story and when their mother in another version of the story want the highest seats next to Jesus in the kingdom of God. He went with Simon Peter to prepare for the Last Supper. And in Acts, he is in the upper room when religious authorities confront he and Peter and arrest them and take them to jail. He goes with Peter to Samaria to see what Philip is preaching. And according to one tradition, he and James are both killed by Herod Agrippa, according to Acts 12 in A.D. 44. If that's the case, then there's no way he could have written the Gospel of John, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John in the book of Revelation, unless he was literally a ghostwriter. But other traditions are that he lived in Ephesus after leaving Jerusalem, was banished to Patmos, was later released from the island of Patmos in 98 by Nerva, after he had written the Apocalypse, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John in the Gospel of John, and then died of natural causes under the Roman Emperor Trajan. John was fiery. He was passionate about his belief, though sometimes that passion got him into trouble. And yet he was, when it came down to it, he was also one of the most loyal and faithful followers of Jesus and one of the most loyal and faithful workers within the ministry of the church. Matthew, also known as Levi, was what? What was his occupation? Tax collector. That's right. We have accounts of his call in Matthew 9, Mark 2, and Luke 5. In the Gospel of Matthew, he's called Matthew. Mark and Luke call him Levi. Some people have said, well, then why did he have two names? Some have said, well, he had two Hebrew names. Others, well, his name was Levi, and Jesus named him Matthew, just like he renamed Simon Peter. Still others claim that he was from the tribe of Levi. Mark states that he is a son of Alphaeus, and if so, then he was also the brother of James, the son of Alphaeus. But he did work for Herod Antipas in Capernaum, collecting custom taxes and taxes on fish along the Damascus Highway, around the Sea of Galilee. As a tax collector, he was considered unclean religiously and outside the law. And as a tax collector in that area, he would have had plenty of opportunity to hear Jesus. But Luke chapter 5 says, when Jesus called him, he collected up all his stuff, got it in his arms, and went with Jesus to his home, right? No. Luke chapter 5, verse 38 said that when Jesus called him, he left everything behind to follow Jesus. Didn't pick up his tax books. Didn't pick up the money he had sitting there. Didn't pocket the excess. When Jesus called him, he left everything that others would think was important in order to follow Jesus. And many believe that the meal Jesus has immediately after that, attended by other tax collectors and sinners, was at Matthew's home. Tradition says he is the author of the gospel. In fact, the early church father Papias claimed that Matthew wrote oracles of the Lord in Hebrew. However, other than his mention in the Gospels, he's never mentioned again in the New Testament. Tradition says he went from Palestine to Ethiopia and to other lands where he was martyred. And actually, there is a church in Ethiopia dedicated to Matthew. But I think the key that we take away from Matthew is the fact that when he felt that call from Jesus, nothing else was important. Everything else took second place at best to that call from Jesus to follow him. Philip. The Synoptic Gospels and the book of Acts only list Philip the Apostle. They don't say anything else about him. John states that he came from Bethsaida and gives four different incidents or statements about him. That he had knowledge of this hope for the Messiah and was an enthusiastic follower of Jesus because he's the one that brought Nathanael. In John chapter 6, he has a role in the feeding of the multitudes. In John chapter 12, he's asked by Greek pilgrims to introduce them to Jesus. And in John 14, it is Philip the apostle that says to Jesus, "Lord, show us the Father, and we will be satisfied." He's not mentioned anywhere else. The evangelist Philip, who was one of the seven deacons chosen in Acts chapter 6, who started a mission in Samaria in Acts chapter 8, and who was the one who converted Simon Magus to Christianity in Acts chapter 8, who helped with the conversion of the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8, and who had four daughters who were evangelists and preached, is a different Philip that was converted in the early Christian church. Some church tradition, though, says that Philip goes to Caesarea for 20 years where he preaches and later becomes bishop of a place called Trae and is martyred at Hierapolis. Thomas. We think of Thomas, we think of what? Thomas the doubter. But actually, Thomas's name comes from the Aramaic Toma, which means twin. John calls him Didymus, which also means twin. And there are four stories about him in the Gospel of John. In John chapter 11, verse 16, he repeats Jesus' invitation to go where Lazarus has died. Some see it as a cynical, "Well, let's go along so we can die with him too." Some people think he was saying bravely, "Well, let's go with him so we can die too." But the fact that he ran later in the Garden of Gethsemane makes you think that he wasn't showing bravery. In John chapter 14, he is the one who responded to Jesus saying he was going to prepare the way or the place for his followers with a question. "Well, show us the way then." And Jesus speaks of himself as the way, the truth, and the life. Of course, the most famous incident that we think of regarding Thomas is what? Okay. When he goes to do that, but what happened a week earlier that we think about? When the disciples said, "Oh, we've seen him, and he's alive, and he was here," and you missed it. What does Thomas say? "I won't believe it until I can do this." And so that's where we get the idea, and we call him Doubting Thomas. John chapter 20. In John chapter 21, he is also one of the disciples that has gone back to fishing. Said, "Well, hey, it's over. Let's go back and fish some more." On Lake Tiberias, when Jesus appears in John chapter 21 to them there at the lake. Later church tradition says that he preached in India, and he started a church in Malabar, India. In fact, there is a church that is dedicated to him in India. A number of years ago, I did a paper on some of the non-canonical literature, including the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Thomas the Contender and some other things. And it sounds, a lot of what's in those things sounds a lot like Hindu teaching, etc. And so it's made me wonder if perhaps Thomas had made it there. Judas Iscariot. According to John chapter 12, the treasurer of the disciples received 30 pieces of silver, according to Matthew, for betraying Jesus. And yet, what did he do with those 30 pieces of silver when he found out Jesus was going to die? brought him back and tried to buy him back. And when they said, you have to live with it, he couldn't. And so he threw the money down and went out and killed himself. Now, the two different versions of his death, in Matthew chapter 27, verses 3 to 10, we're told he brings that back, and then he goes out, and how does he kill himself? Yep, that's right, Bobby, he hangs himself. In Acts chapter 1, verses 16 to 21, he supposedly goes out to this field and starts looking, and he falls over and swells up and explodes. What probably happened is he probably hung himself, and then later the rope broke and he hit the ground like a melon. But his last name was not Iscariot, although there are different understandings of that last name. Some say that it means man from Kerioth, and it does. Kerioth was a town that was a haven for zealots, and there are many who believe that Judas was a zealot who thought that he had found that earthly political Messiah the zealots were looking for and tried to force Jesus to be that. Among the zealots was a group known as the Sicarios, dagger men. Some have suggested that as a zealot, that his name Iscariot is a way of saying he is a Sicarii, that is, a dagger bearer. Once again, a zealot. Some claimed that it means man of Issachar. Guess Warren Beatty would like to know that. Or that it comes from the Aramaic term that means hypocrite. But we do know that he is the only one of Jesus' followers that was not from the area around Galilee. He was from the tribe of Judah, David's country, where Jerusalem was located. One tradition is that he might have even been the brother of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, but there's no proof for that. Some have even suggested that in John chapter 13, if you read 13, 21 to 26, you can almost see Jesus is the one reclining nearest, Judas is the one reclining nearest Jesus at the Last Supper. In fact, Luke chapter 22 indicates that Judas participated in the Last Supper fully, taking the bread and the wine just like all the other disciples did. And there are many different possible reasons as to why he might have betrayed Jesus. Judas, which is a form of Judah, was a very popular name among Jews. But Jewish Christians ceased to name their children Judah or Judas after what Judas did. And yet, do we not all at some point in our lives betray Jesus? And the question is, did Jesus have forgiveness for Judas as well? But then we come back to a couple of other folks that we haven't mentioned yet, that we know very little about. Simon Zelotes, Simon the Zealot. He's mentioned in Luke 6. Acts 1, as he's also called Simon the Canaanian, because he was from Cana in Galilee, where Jesus did what? Yep, changed the water to wine. First miracle that is recorded in the Gospel of John. First one of the signs. Also, the name Canaan in Aramaic means the zealous one. Judas was a zealot. He was looking for the earthly political Messiah. We don't find him mentioned even in church tradition later. Do we know? Was he one of those who very zealously worked behind the scenes? Or was he one that fell by the wayside later because Jesus wasn't the zealot's Messiah? Well, the fact that he is listed among the disciples present at the day of Pentecost in the book of Acts, I think at least implies very strongly that he didn't fall by the wayside. But like some others, he was one of those who continued to work wherever he was needed, doing whatever was needed to be done. The other is Judas Thaddeus. Ed's Judas. The good one, right? Judas Thaddeus. In the RSV, Revised Standard Version, he is in Luke and John called the son of James, the just. In the King James Version, he is the brother of James. He is simply listed as Thaddeus in Matthew and Mark. And you want to know something? Outside of the lists in the New Testament, in the Gospels and the book of Acts, there's not even church tradition about Judas Thaddeus. But I don't think, as I've already said about some others, that that is any reason to doubt his sincerity or his importance. Because you see, importance in Christ's church is not measured by who's on first or who's in first place or who's the most vocal. But in that famous encounter where James and John wanted to very vocally be considered the best of Jesus' disciples, having places of honor, in every description of that in the Gospels, what does Jesus say about the importance of his followers? The first shall be last. And the greatest among you will be the servant, or the least of all. And so while, David, we don't know a whole lot about those early followers. I know his handwriting. I've known it for a long time. While we don't know a whole lot about those early followers, at the same time, I think that we can rest assured that each one did his own part. At some point in time. Yes, David. Do what?
Specifically, did not use the word.
Well, you said earliest followers, so I presumed.
I know we don't have time to talk about Paul. Was Mary Magdalene prostitute? And or was Mary Magdalene?
Some church traditions say, yes, there is no evidence in the biblical text whatsoever. The Bible never indicates that Mary Magdalene, or Mary of Magdala, was the woman brought before Jesus in the Gospel of John and thrown down, having been caught in the act of prostitution. Of course, the guy wasn't brought. He was probably in the crowd. But there is no place in the New Testament at all. That is later church tradition. No place in the New Testament at all that Mary is equated with that woman or the woman. Actually, she is not mentioned specifically as the woman who washed Jesus' feet with her tears and dried them with her hair. That is a presumption and an interpretation that came about in church history. That's a very good question. But no, there is no biblical evidence to link her as that person. And there is actually no biblical evidence, though we often presume as well, that Mary, the sister of Martha and Lazarus, was a prostitute. And some people in church tradition try to do that, and then they draw a line from Mary, the sister of Martha and Lazarus, to Mary of Magdala that they think might have been the woman caught in the act of adultery, to the woman at the house of Simon, the Pharisee who anointed Jesus and then washed his feet with her tears and dried them with her hair, and there is no definitive link whatsoever. That's just church tradition. Anything else? Presumably, and once again, this is presumption, but Jesus was born a Jew. He did learn under and study under the rabbis in the synagogue. And even though there was only one from the tribe of Judah, all the other 11 were from the area around Galilee, etc., the northern half of the earlier kingdom, if you would. There, in Hebrew numerology and in Hebrew teaching, there is significance to the number 12, the 12 tribes. And if you go to the Apocalypse, you've got the understanding that, or the description in the Apocalypse, that in Jerusalem you've got the 12 gates, and you've got the foundations of those gates, and they're linked with not only the 12 tribes of Israel, but they're also the name of each of the 12 apostles is written on those foundation stones, etc. So once again, I would think that given Jesus' Jewishness, and it's a very good book by James Charlesworth, who used to be at Duke and is now at Princeton, Jesus Within Judaism, came out a number of years ago, where he argues that far too often we as Christians miss a lot of Jesus' significance because we take him out of Judaism and make him Christian instead of seeing him within Judaism and what he built on there, and how we have the same foundation and the same God and many of the same teachings, and that we can learn a whole lot more when we see Jesus first within Judaism and then what developed through Jesus' teachings out of that than when we separate. And I would think, and some scholars that I have read in the past who I think probably are correct, that since Jesus was born and raised within Judaism and things were done by the law, and he did attend synagogue and he did learn everything he could, that link of 12 was in keeping with the 12 tribes of Israel. Others. Easy answer is only God knows for sure.
Is death inappropriate time of being in sin and wasn't forgiven? But in other words, he died at a bad time. In other words, he lived a little bit longer, he'd been forgiven, he got back on.
Right, and the presumption he could have gone to Jesus and asked for forgiveness. Some have tried to argue, including Frederick Buechner, have tried to argue that, or not argue, but posit the idea that in his extreme, that he never intended. And personally, that and a dollar will get you a drink machine. I don't think Judas intended for Jesus to die. I think Judas wanted to push him to be the Messiah. Judas believed he was supposed to be. And if indeed he, and there are some who would posit the idea, others who would posit the idea that when he found out Jesus was going to die, in his bringing back of the money, he was actually trying to buy Jesus back. He said, "Here, you know what I mean? I betrayed innocent blood. I don't want him to die." And they said, "We've already paid you. Keep the money. Live with it." And the fact that he didn't even go out and get drunk with the money. You know, he threw it down, he left it there. They bought the potter's field because it was blood money. But I mean, he left it there and he went out and in great sorrow couldn't live with it. Killed himself. That in itself, since he had been such a close follower of Jesus, that in itself was his way of saying, okay, you know, I can't do anything about it now, but throwing himself at God's mercy. I don't know. But, you know, we like to consign Judas to the nethermost reaches of hell. Dante placed him, as I've mentioned before, Dante placed him in a lake of ice, not even a lake of fire. So far removed from God that it was cold, and you know, ice burns as well as fire. And yet, as Buechner raises the point, if Jesus was not about, at the point of the kiss, if Jesus was not about to go out and die for even Judas, then how can any of us presume that he died for us? Because we betray Jesus like Judas betrays Jesus. So, you look at the thief on the cross. You know, and he didn't say, "Jesus, save me." He said, "Just think about me, remember me." He defended Jesus.
It's just
But
for the 12 disciples, he's still accepted as a disciple.
Right.
Is he the only one that's not a saint?
Now, I've never known of St. Judas. But, I mean, you got... Well, and some of these are, but you know, we don't hear anything even in church tradition about Simon Zelotes, and you know, and a couple of these others, and so you know, don't know if they're saints or not. I don't even know who Christopher was. I mean, you can look it up in church tradition, but you know, he wasn't one of the 12. So you know, that's a hard call, but I leave, and quite frankly. As much as we, and it's interesting to speculate about these things, and I turn that one over a lot. I mean, I actually do turn that one over a lot. We as human beings want to judge, but we're told not to judge. That's God's purview, and so I don't know if God. I would hope that perhaps somewhere Jesus saw something good in Judas when he called him. And Judas obviously did some good things with the disciples while he was a follower of Jesus. I guess the hopeful side of me would hope and pray that somewhere God had forgiveness for Judas. I know that one of the theories as to why he did it was part of God's predestined plan. That's a Calvinistic approach. Well, if that's the case, then how can you blame Judas? You know. That kind of stuff. David?
Sort of along the same lines. Not from a disciplinarian standpoint. Somebody had to do it. Not necessarily God made you do it, but somebody had to do it. So is it not the same assumption for forgiveness and for God's ultimate plan to be fulfilled? Somebody had to do it.
That would be one way to look at it. That it, yeah. Why would, if somebody had to, and perhaps Judas or Simon Zelotes, both of whom may have been zealots, would be the most likely candidates to think they'd found this political earthly Messiah, because that's what Messiah initially meant to the Jews for much of their history. Then why would God give the ultimate punishment to that person for doing something that was part of what eventually became necessary? But I don't want, at the same time, the other thing is it's dangerous to push that too far. Oh, well, God told me to put my baby in a microwave. That was a defense supposedly used by a woman in Chicago a few years ago. You know, God told me to put my baby in a microwave to save its soul. No. So, you know, I think we have to be careful. I see that, but at the same time, I think we've got to be careful about how far we push some things, because other people can then use them for excuses. But, you know, I mean, as I said, that I don't think Judas betrayed him for the money at all. He brought the money back. But the, I mean, there are people who believe that, and that's, you know, that's okay. That's between you and God. But... I think there was a whole lot more in it. And part of that was Judas' personality and where he was from. And if indeed he betrayed Jesus, thinking he was putting him in a place where Jesus would have to prove he was the Messiah, then you could also argue that he had more belief in Jesus as Messiah, because the other disciples didn't understand fully what Messiahship was. They took swords in the garden also. They tried to defend him. He may have had a stronger faith in what Jesus could do than even Simon Peter at that point in time. I don't know. Yes, Linda. Matthias? Very little. We find him mentioned as a replacement. But we really don't find him mentioned anywhere else in the New Testament. He was a replacement. He was one who had followed Jesus from the beginning and had witnessed the resurrection. So at some point he had seen the resurrected Christ. He was hanging out with the others when he did, because that was part of the criteria from the early days through the resurrection. If you look in the book of Acts, that was the criteria they used. And he was obviously present there and had something to do with the growth of the church. But beyond that, we really don't know anything about Matthias. I know I'm cutting into singing time. Didn't mean for this one to run so long. I thought this was going to be a short one. David. But where what? Oh, by now he's long dead. The text never says where Joseph is. The presumption is that since Jesus is called in different places, in one gospel he's called the carpenter's son, in the other gospel he's called the carpenter. Joseph is never mentioned. And Jesus grows up under the tutelage of Joseph and Mary. We have him mentioned early, and he is never mentioned again after Jesus becomes a man. Probably Joseph died before Jesus became started his public ministry, because any time, even when his mother and his brothers come, because people think he's crazy and they come, they want to get him away from preaching. They say, "Come on, you need to go home." And the folks say, "Your mother and your brothers are outside wanting you." And he says, "Well, who are my mother and my brothers? Anyone who does the will of my father that sent me?" Joseph's not mentioned. And he probably would have been, had he been in the picture. So most folks and most scholars would say that Joseph, and you know, even early church fathers and church historians, Joseph was out of the picture before Jesus did, presumably dead. Yes, Wesley.
Now, Satan might have to put more of a point in that here, but gives him credit.
Oh, Judas?
Yeah.
That's one of the theories, because one of the gospel writers said, then the devil entered into him and he went out to betray him. And that is a possibility, but if the devil made him do it, Flip Wilson. Geraldine.
Well, if he believed more in the devil than he did in Jesus, then he would do something like that.
Well, that's possible.
The devil gets told, though, he ain't going to say what he might do.
No. But sometimes in a weak moment, we might do something the devil wants us to do that we would repent for later. So, yeah, I don't know. But then again, if the devil did influence him, then how do we give Judas the whole blame as well?
Like Peter. The devil spoke to him 3 times.
You could say that the devil spoke to him 3 times. And when Peter, you're right, Ken, and when Peter said that Jesus was Messiah, and then later in the Great Confession in Mark 8:30 and following, and then Jesus starts telling him he's got to go suffer and be killed, and Peter rebukes him. What does Jesus say to Peter? "Get behind me, Satan." Now, he didn't say Peter was Satan, but what he's saying is, you're trying to influence me the same way that the devil tried to influence me earlier, not to accomplish my mission. But, I mean, of course, you know, these are... only God knows for sure, but at the same time, I think it's important for us to try, and because we can sometimes see some of ourselves in these disciples, the good and the bad and the ugly. Oh, sorry. Old Western movie, Clint Eastwood. Oh. Next week's question. I don't know if I can do this in just 5 verses. Parenting is more and more difficult these days. What 5 verses in the Bible stand out as those that all parents should turn to in rearing their children? And how are those verses relevant to today? Be interesting. I don't know if I can narrow it down to 5 verses, but we'll try. Next week we'll talk about child rearing. What the Bible says about child rearing. Let's see. Spare the rods. But we will talk about child rearing next week. And how's the Bible relevant today to raising children? Thank you. As you go, know this, that while we may or may not know much about those early followers of Jesus, we too are followers of Jesus. And just as some of them were strong, and some of them were not so strong, and some who were strong at times proved to be weak even later on, there was forgiveness and there was purpose that Christ brought into their lives. And it is that same forgiveness and purpose and call that you and I have, just as when He said to them, "Come and follow Me." God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.